The Christina Borgeson Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
What if you had a great idea to deal with a big, urgent problem, and you had the resources to carry out that idea, and then all of a sudden, you find yourself in a buzzsaw? Well, that's what happened to my guest today. My guest is Steve Kirsch, and he had come up with the idea of founding and funding a COVID-19 early treatment fund that would be used to research FDA drugs approved for other diseases to see if they could work for COVID. Now, good ideas are Steve Kirsch's stock in trade. He's a brilliant electrical engineer and MIT grad who made a fortune as a tech entrepreneur. He founded 7 tech companies, including Propel Software, a platform for developing and deploying e-commerce. He's the CEO of Abaca, that provides spam filter technology. And he's best known for founding InfoSeek, one of the first internet search engines that was acquired by Walt Disney. Turns out, Kirsch's great idea for quickly bringing effective COVID treatment to the public with drugs already on the market was a very controversial thing to do. Now, he puts his personal fortune in ventures that he thinks are urgent for keeping humanity safe. This is not his only venture. And I'm sure the last thing he expected when he started his COVID-19 Early Treatment Foundation was to be whipsawed by attacks from various quarters. After all, he solved very tough problems before, including keeping himself alive after being diagnosed with a deadly blood cancer. So today we're going to hear the details of Kirsch's journey, see how he's faring, and what he's looking forward to. Welcome, Steve.
Thanks, Cecilia. It's good to be here.
So why don't we start at the beginning, because I think the beginning is very important, which is, am I correct that you were at least partially inspired to come up with this COVID-19 early treatment fund because of the experience that you had coming up with your own effective treatment for your own cancer?
Not really. I mean, through the trying to solve my own cancer, I certainly got in touch with a bunch of doctors, but I had already been funding medical research for 10 years prior to that. So I've been funding medical research for 20 years. So the idea for the early treatment actually came from the doctors themselves. They said that early treatments are the fastest, cheapest, and safest way to end the pandemic. And they were all confused as to why the government wasn't putting any money at all into this. In fact, none of the world governments anywhere were doing anything, and the World Health Organization wasn't doing anything either. And in fact, when I suggested to the World Health Organization that they should take a look at early treatments, they basically told me to go away and don't contact them again.
Did that raise any red flags for you at the time?
Well, no, I basically just thought it was total incompetence on their part. So I just basically said, well, you know, clearly as an entrepreneur, you always look for market opportunities. And this seemed like a market opportunity because none of the governments anywhere was even talking about early treatments. And they were all talking about investing billions of dollars in vaccines instead of taking the fast, easy, and cheap route out of the pandemic, which had been already demonstrated or back in March of 2020, right soon after it started. There was an early treatment protocol that was pioneered by George Farid and Brian Tyson in Southern California. And they've got a track record of zero deaths, that if you go to them with COVID, starting in March of 2020, and you stay on their protocol, nobody dies.
What was their protocol?
Oh, it's published. There's an Amazon bestseller with their protocol, but it combines a bunch of repurposed drugs. So right. It has things like hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin and fluvoxamine and, you know, the usual suspects. And it's been refined over time as they learn more about what works and what doesn't work. And they've been swapping things in and out. But it's basically a combination of repurposed drugs as well as supplements like vitamin D and whatnot. And it's been, you know, just remarkably effective. And they tried to get the CDC to pay attention to it, and they were denied any kind of there was no interest at all from the government on that. They were all just focused on the vaccine, because that's what Tony Fauci wanted, is that we cure COVID via vaccines. We don't cure COVID with early treatment. And this is not the first time that Tony Fauci has, you know, had that sort of attitude towards things. And so that's what everybody did. They just followed Tony's advice, and they ignored all the early treatments, even though they were remarkably successful.
Take me through the timeline of your experience, because at some point, obviously, it sounds like a great market opportunity. Here's this thing, you can take care of people easily and cheaply. That's, you know, I mean, that sounds like a perfect business plan. So talk to me about when you set this thing up, and then when you first started realizing that there was opposition to what you were doing. What were your experiences?
Yeah, so it started probably a April time frame, when I was basically, nobody was going into work, right? Because everybody was staying at home and, you know, wondering what to do. And so I called around, you know, got the idea for the early treatment fund. I put in $1 million of my own money. Over time, I raised $5 million in additional funding to fund the clinical trials. And we were involved in the development of at least four drugs, all of them successful. It's Camistat, fluvoxamine, interferon lambda, and hydroxychloroquine. And so I was the one who funded David Boulware's study, which, when it came out, said, oh, hydroxychloroquine doesn't provide a statistically significant benefit. And so that's when the FDA basically pulled the plug on the EUA for hydroxychloroquine, was after that study that I funded. But the thing is that the study, if you analyzed it properly, you'd have found a statistically significant benefit from hydroxychloroquine, because they didn't take into account the shipping delays of the drug. And when David Weissman, who analyzed this data, then by incorporating the shipping data, when he tried to get that his paper published, to say that no, you know, David Boulware made a mistake on his original HCQ paper, that here is the correct result, he couldn't get a journal to publish it for some reason. So, you know, that was I don't know why that is, because David Weissman's a very careful guy, and he's very, very meticulous. Anybody who knows David Weissman will tell you this guy is one of the most meticulous people that you have ever met in your lifetime. And so he found this result that said, hey, if you give hydroxychloroquine early, and you give it with the right combination of other drugs and so forth, it works. It's statistically significant to be beneficial. And couldn't get that paper published for some reason. And it's sort of, so I ended up funding the fluvoxamine research. And the first study, we had 100% success rate. Anybody who got the drug, none of them met the hospitalization criteria. And there was somewhere around 8.6% of the people who got the placebo. Meaning that the drug was 100% effective in keeping people out of the hospital. And so we replicated that in a real world trial because I was talking to someone who basically he had an outbreak at he had an outbreak at the Golden Gate racetrack, and I was on a podcast with him and told him about fluvoxamine. He decided to use fluvoxamine to treat people at the racetrack, even though it wasn't FDA approved for COVID. And there was the paper that came out from the phase two trial was already published in JAMA, but the editors cautioned doctors, do not use it, you know, because we need more data before you use it. But he used it anyway, because he's allowed to, because it's just it's an FDA approved drug. So he could use it off label for a different reason. And so he used it for fluvoxamine, and he treated 77 patients with fluvoxamine. None of them were hospitalized, and all of them recovered within days. And they were all complaining, hey, why won't you let us get back to work? You know, we feel fine. Let's get back to work. And the people who refused the fluvoxamine, they were the ones that were in bed, hospitalized or dead. And so there were 12.5% of the people who didn't take the drug were hospitalized or dead versus 0% of the people who did. And it was so impressive that even the management of the racetrack who didn't have COVID said, hey, write me a prescription so I can take the drug instead of just in case I get COVID. And so so what happened after that is we said, well, we should apply to the FDA, because clearly everybody at the racetrack was totally convinced, because they could see their friends who took the drug did phenomenally well. And anyone who didn't take the drug was like, you know, in bed and suffering or in the hospital or dead. And so completely obvious to people at the racetrack whether the drug worked or not. I mean, we're talking like, you know, lots of people. But the FDA reviewed it, and they came back after 6 weeks and they said, we don't see any kind of sign that the benefits outweigh the risks. You know, you don't have sufficient evidence. You know, it's the same thing that they do with hydroxychloroquine, what they do with ivermectin. And so, you know, and the doctors all said, well, you need a phase three trial. And I'm looking at the math on this, right? Because I'm an engineer, so I do the calculation. And there were, of the 77 people who got the drug, there was no long-haul COVID, zero. And so that can't happen if the drug didn't work. The chances of that happening just by chance is 10 to the minus, you know, 1 in 10 to the 14th. So it's very slim odds that it's going to happen by chance. It has to be that the drug works. I mean, this is more convincing proof than the vaccine works by orders of magnitude. And so it was stunning to me that the FDA said, oh, we're not convinced by the evidence. And by the way, it wasn't a randomized trial. And I thought to myself, yeah, it wasn't a randomized trial. All the people who were really sick went for the drug. And all the people who weren't sick said, hey, I don't need the drug. I'm just going to go, you know, on my own. And what happened was we cured all the really sick people, and all the really healthy people ended up, you know, or 12.5% of them either ended up hospitalized or dead. So clearly, this was a non-randomized trial, but it's a non-randomized trial where we got stuck with all of the unhealthy patients. And so to get a 100% success rate in that is absolutely stunning. It's a better than randomized. But the you can't argue with the FDA because they won't reply to you. they just ignore you after they issue their response to say, well, we don't believe that the drug that you have enough evidence to convince us. So then what happened is that we had a trial in Brazil, and that took a year, that added a year to the timeline. And the trial in Brazil was monitored by the WHO, and they really liked the trial, and the trial showed that the drug was amazingly successful. In fact, one of the statistics they had is that it had a 12 times reduction in death if you took the drug early. And so, and then they also got a peer-reviewed meta-analysis and systematic review, which is the highest level of evidence in evidence in evidence-based medicine. So, you know, all doctors should follow that. It's like winning a case in the Supreme Court. And so what happened is the FDA, another application was made to the FDA for an EUA, and they turned it down due to insufficient evidence. Again, even after a peer-reviewed systematic review and meta-analysis, which is the highest evidence possible in evidence-based medicine, the FDA said that's insufficient evidence. So we, you know, there's no way to spin that. That is corruption at the highest levels. There is no rock you can hide under. And this is why nobody at the FDA or the NIH or the CDC wants to appear on camera with me to talk about this, because there's no way you can defend this. I mean, I've talked to the researchers who did the trials, and I asked one of them who did the main trial, hey, did anyone at the FDA reach out to you? Because they cited your trial as one of the reasons for denying this application. They said, oh, that trial was ended for futility. And I asked, did the FDA ever reach out to you to find out why it was ended for futility? And they said, no, nobody ever contacted them. And if they had contacted them, they would find out that the reason it was futile is because nobody in the placebo group, so nobody who didn't get the drug, was getting hospitalized. And so you can't show an effect if the core treatment that everybody is getting, because they have to get the standard of care treatment, you know, which at the time was, ivermectin and whatnot. And so if nobody's falling ill, you can enroll a million patients and you'll never show an effect. And so that's why it was terminated, is because they were getting existing treatments. And
okay, we're going to have to take a break pretty soon. So,
sure. No problem.
Go ahead.
I'll try to finish up quickly, but the bottom line is that these guys are corrupt. I mean, that the bottom line is that, and I never believed that before. And so this was eye-opening to me, because I always trusted the FDA and the CDC and the NIH, and I thought it was all, you know, above board and there was no corruption. But I've come to learn with these powerful examples, that nobody wants to go on the record and have a discussion with me about it. There's no way that they can deny this stuff if they're being honest.
We'll be right back with Steve Kirsch.
Dolores Cahill on TNT Radio.
They're engineering these cycles, right? If they know they want to have a cycle by changing the value of the loan-to-asset ratio, or that if the banks and the regulators work together and they know a cycle is coming, they can profit by it and also use the downturn in the cycle to claim the assets that they didn't actually own initially.
Exactly right, Dolores. What if you, as Kevin said, if you study history, what they do is they inflate assets and then they strip them from the people that they allegedly lend money to. When you understand how the money system really works, there are no loans as such, not in the way that they portray them to be. So what they do is they inflate, it's boom and bust. There's no reason for boom and bust economies. It's created deliberately so that people can have their assets inflated and then taken from them. And then you rebuild, assets get inflated and they take them. The whole model is based on asset stripping. That's banking.
Weekends with Dolores Cahill on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
The United States government has declared you an enemy of the state. For the first time in history, a foreign journalist has been charged under the U.S. Espionage Act for publishing truthful information about war crimes. If convicted, our right to free press is over. We have been led to despise the journalist charged by a massive smear campaign directed at both the left and the right, yet his record speaks for itself.
He's the only journalist to have never gotten it wrong.
The charges are opposed by all major human rights and free press organizations, but our once trusted news outlets have failed to inform us. It is not too late. We can demand the UK stop the extradition of journalist and publisher Julian Assange. We can demand the Department of Justice drop the charges. Call UK Home Secretary Priti Patel at 020-7219-3528 or call the Department of Justice at 202-514-2000. They are not after him. They're after us.
Emergency, police, fire, or ambulance?
Yeah, I'm just passing through.
Police, fire, or ambulance?
I can see a whole lot of smoke.
What town are you calling from?
I'm on a mobile phone.
I need the town.
Yeah, there it is. I can see flames. It appears to be a kid or something at the window.
It's okay.
You guys are better out. This is serious.
Hello?
Triple Zero's sole job is to connect you to emergency services. If you stay focused and just answer the prompted questions, you'll get help faster.
Get breaking news on your phone when it happens. Download our app from the Google Play and App Store now.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
We're back with Steve Kirsch, founder and funder of the COVID-19 Early Treatment Fund. That was researching repurposed drugs for early treatment for COVID when he ran into a buzzsaw, and he's talking about his experience. I just want to back up and ask you a quick question for David Boulware's his study. You funded that to the tune of about $125,000, right? I mean, when you went back to him and asked him about the shipping aspect that had not been considered in his study, what did he say to you?
He said not to talk to him again. Basically, I'd referred a friend of mine to have a discussion with him, and he didn't like one of the emails that my friend said, so he basically said, don't talk to me ever again.
You're kidding, right? I mean...
No, I'm not. No, you can't. Wow. You can't joke about this stuff.
Okay, so...
Yeah, it's same reaction I had when I had a 12-member or 13-member scientific advisory board for the COVID-19 Early Treatment Fund, and... when I started speaking out against the vaccine and explaining that the vaccines are actually dangerous, all of them quit within a week, and they all said, never talk to us again. We never want to hear from you again in our life. Do not contact us.
And I mean, what was
that's
your...
That's Christina, that's the way science works.
I mean, you must have been completely weirded out by all that. You know,
I thought it was pretty strange, because I thought that disagreements in science are supposed to be settled through evidence, and I had requested them to say, look, if I got it wrong on the vaccine, then show me where I got it wrong. Show me the evidence that shows that I'm wrong. And they all said, no, we never want to talk to you again. You're wrong. We never want to talk to you again, and we will not supply you with any evidence showing that you're wrong.
Go ahead.
Was stunning. Yeah, no, it was stunning.
So what did you do? What did you do then?
You mean after they resigned? That was in...
Yeah.
This is now over a year. So I'd run the COVID-19 Early Treatment Fund since March or April of 2020. And I didn't find out the vaccines were dangerous until May of 2021. So, you know, we're looking at basically over a year where I had a scientific advisory board, and then I came out and then they said, you know, see you later. And I said, you know, fine. But by then we had already basically discovered five drugs, all of which worked against COVID. So Camistat, fluvoxamine, interferon lambda, hydroxychloroquine, and that's four of them. There's a fifth. I'm not recalling it. But so in basically less than a year, a Silicon Valley entrepreneur found five drugs that worked against COVID and was instrumental in helping to move those along. But nothing happened with any of those drugs. Right.
Well,
and yet I still trusted the system. which is kind of surprising, you know, in hindsight. I still thought that at least the vaccines were safe, even though they were clearly trying to dissuade people from using early treatments. I thought, well, everything that they must be saying about the vaccines must be true, because the FDA, like even today, like the FDA will stop Jif peanut butter on 10 cases of salmonella poisoning. And, you know, so Jif has this massive recall on their peanut butter because of 10 cases of poisoning where nobody died. And there are other, there's another case. Let me see. Let me bring it up.
Well, did
quick.
You ever stop to think about, since you sent you submitted your studies for your drugs for approval, FDA approval, and they took 6 weeks. This is when they were really needed, you know?
Yeah.
And
no, of course.
Did you ever consider, did you ever go back to them and say, well, you know, Operation Warp Speed, your clinical trials not only lasted only for months, but, and they were literally making the vaccines while they were doing the clinical trials on those vaccines. And then they would put the vaccines on the trucks. And if at the end of 3 or 4 months of really shoddy stuff work, they realized the vaccines had no efficacy at all, they got rid of them. It was like an assembly line that, by the way, the U.S. taxpayer paid for upfront for all of them. You know, the ones they approved and the ones they threw away. Okay, and this is 3 months. And of course, now, according to Dr. Paul Alexander, who was advising the Trump administration on COVID policy and was part of the Warp Speed thing, he was against Warp Speed. You know, he said that Pfizer's numbers were fraudulent. They were putting fraudulent numbers forward to get those vaccines on those trucks and out. So here you are, they make you wait 6 weeks compared to Operation Warp Speed. I mean, and then they, you know, they just, you know, dismiss your submission. So that's quite a stark difference.
Yeah, well, you have to remember that the submission was before the vaccines were available. There's no alternative, right? And so they basically looked at this data. They spent 6 weeks. I couldn't believe it. There's nothing in sight. There's nothing available that's approved for COVID. And it took them 6 weeks to get back to me saying insufficient data. Man, you know, I just couldn't believe it. I thought we'd get a response back within a couple of weeks at most. Because, I mean, the evidence is so compelling. 77 people, zero hospitalization, zero long-haul COVID. that can't happen by luck. There's no way to
explain
that.
When did you submit that?
Must have been, I think it was November of... I think somewhere in the November timeframe of 2021.
Okay,
yeah, it was before
they started.
The vaccines
didn't they start rolling out? Wait a second. When did they start
December
rolling
19th.
Out?
December 19th.
Yeah, but just a month. Just a month.
Yeah.
Later,
well,
right?
let me see. I'll have to pull up the dates here.
I mean,
let's see if I can.
I'm looking at my notes too, and I believe it was December 2020 that they rolled them out. So they were doing the Operation Warp Speed before that, at the same time that you were submitting yours, basically.
Yeah.
So think about that for a minute.
Yeah, let's
that.
See. I'm trying to see if I have some.
Anyway, I'm pretty sure that's the time.
Yeah, you know, it existed. It looks like it was done in early 2021. So it'd be after the vaccines rolled out. And And so I'm asking, so here I've got an email to Peter Stein asking about, hey, what, you know, what's going on with my EUA? It's February 22nd, 2021. So this is after the vaccine's rolled out. So I guess they're in no hurry at that point because we have the safe and effective vaccine, supposedly. And so therefore they can dilly-dally on early treatments. I guess that's how they rationalize it.
By this time, though, and also, what was happening to you personally when all this was when all this came down after your board walked out and so on? I mean, you were getting attacked.
Yeah, you know,
crazy.
I was publishing on. I published this big piece. It was 285 pages. I wrote it in about 3 weeks, and it was this big article published in TrialSite News. And it basically said, should you get vaccinated? And, you know, asked the question, and the answer, according to my research, was absolutely not. This thing is super dangerous, and the signals in the VAERS system have been flashing red alert, you know, danger Will Robinson since January of 2021 when they first rolled out. And the CDC has just been ignoring every single safety signal. So one of the safety signals is that women's heavy menstrual bleeding is elevated like, you know, 8,890 times normal for the VAERS database. So this is clearly, there is no doubt. You'd only have to look at the top symptom that's reported into VAERS, the heavy menstrual bleeding. And you knew at an instant that the VAERS reports were not overreported, because you can't overreport by 10,000 fold. You know, there's no way. And no, this is why nobody wants to talk to me about the VAERS data, because the FDA just says, oh, we don't pay attention to that. They're just reporting. The reason there's so many deaths reported into VAERS is just they're reporting background deaths because VAERS is now front and center and everybody knows about it. And so people are just reporting background deaths that just happen to occur at the same time that people are vaccinated, of course, because, you know, we get 50,000 people a week in America who die every month. Or sorry, every week it's 50. It's like 50,000 a week, and so they said, well, you know, these 6,000 or 12,000 deaths reported in the VAERS system, those are just, you know, background deaths, and there's nothing unusual going on. But if you we call that a hand waving argument, because it's an argument that is done by saying, you know, just believe me, believe the authority, and it comes with no evidence. So they never had any evidence to back up that claim. They just hoped that people would buy that and then not check the database and realize that, how do you explain that heavy menstrual bleeding is elevated by 8,800 times normal if it's just overreporting? I mean, that just doesn't pass the sniff test. But nobody's asking that question because they're all believing the CDC saying, oh, VAERS is unreliable and you can't trust it. And if there was a signal there, believe me, we would be on it. And yeah, you know, these guys are still totally corrupt. This is why I can't.
Go ahead.
I offered $1 million to these guys to come on camera with me and answer a few questions, and nobody took my offer. So I increased it. I said, okay, fine, name your price. If $1 million for 4 hours isn't enough, then name your price. And nobody got back to me.
No takers. No.
I want to talk about, can't figure it out.
Sure you can. Since we're talking about VAERS statistics, I mean, there was a recent VAERS report that, we know that VAERS is under reported, but the recent VAERS report says there have been 1,261 241,147 reports. Out of that, you have 27,968 deaths, so that's a little over 2%.
Yeah, but they're not all U.S.
No,
see,
that's
the thing. You have to be careful.
But, okay.
You know, that's worldwide. You're citing worldwide numbers. See, a number of people, you know, but
what I'm trying to do is take the percentages just from this report thing, because you have, I'm not saying, you know, overall, because we know VAERS is underreported. We also know, yes, it is worldwide, but you know, it's not just the deaths, because they have 51,996 permanently disabled people. Permanently disabled. We have to break for messages, but we'll be right back to talk about this.
The midterms and America votes on November 8th. With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Jeremy Beck.
It's very important that former President Donald Trump's candidate endorsements for the midterm elections have favored the minority view in the GOP that sending weapons to Ukraine to fight Russia is a very bad strategy. It is prolonging military conflict, risks nuclear war, and has an enormous cost. One such Trump endorsement for the Georgia primary is Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene. She has slammed President Biden for doing the bidding of the military-industrial complex. She notes that intelligence briefings with reasons why we have to go to war with Russia are similar to the intelligence community telling lies about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Aside from Marjorie Taylor Greene's wise comments on the military-industrial complex, she has fought hard against COVID mask and vaccine mandates, for 9/11 truth, and much more. She's one courageous freedom fighter to watch. I'm Jeremy Beck for TNT Radio.
Hi, I'm Smokey Bear, and I made an assistant to help you out, because only you can prevent wildfires.
Hey, Assistant Smokey Bear, call me Papa Bear, because I'm grilling up dinner. Do you get it?
Yes, good job.
So, what should I do with all these coals?
Don't just toss them out. Put them in a metal container, because those embers can start a wildfire.
I understand. The stakes are high.
Ha, 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 ha.
Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
Bad government, climate change alarmists, vaccine mandates. The threats to your freedom are many, but that's where we can help.
Hear more truths.
TNT Radio.
All the time.
Our truth shall set you free. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
I'm back with tech entrepreneur Steve Kirsch, who ran into a universe of corruption after founding and funding a COVID-19 early treatment fund, where he was trying to do research to get repurposed drugs approved, FDA approved, for early treatment protocols that worked. So let's talk about what happened to you after. Okay, so what happened to you after, you know, your FDA submissions are submission is rejected, your board is gone. What did you do?
Oh, I focused on the vaccines, of course, because at the time, remember, we got rejected in February, in like March of 2021. And that's when I got shot up with two doses of Moderna, and my family got shot up too. And then about a month later, I started.
Why?
Oh, because I was told that these vaccines are perfectly safe and effective. And even though I realized that they were stonewalling me on the early treatment, I didn't think that they were that corrupt that they would basically approve the most dangerous vaccine in human history and then mandate that everybody get shot with it, you know, or try to mandate that everybody get shot with it. And so I didn't think it was that bad. I mean, I didn't think that the FDA was corrupted. I always thought that my reasoning was this: if the FDA said that the evidence on fluvoxamine was insufficient, that the fact that the FDA approved the vaccines must mean that the safety profile and the efficacy profile must be off the charts because they have such high standards. Right? So that
But didn't
was
you
the,
know about Operation Warp Speed? I mean,
of course. Yeah, of course.
And did you know that basically they were just doing, you know, they were EUA'd after 3 months? I mean, normally it takes, you know, 10 to 15 years to approve it.
Sure, but I thought that, wow, this is new modern technology and it's high tech and it uses a different technique which allows them to get to market faster, and they're using a platform which has been used probably it's been used it was used for gene therapy before, and so you know they're sort of repurposing some existing technology and readapting it here at warp speed. And that, again, based on, wow, the FDA is so strict, they wouldn't approve fluvoxamine or ivermectin because they required so much evidence that they're tough cookies to try to crack. And so therefore, if you had something that passed their bar, it must be supremely safe. And so that's how I was operating. That's why I got the vaccine. I got the vaccine because, hey, even though I knew about fluvoxamine and other drugs, I said, hey, you know, can't hurt to have an extra level of protection because it's completely safe. Can't, you know, there are no downsides. Boy, was I naive.
So what was your, you know, I mean, I'm a whistleblower in the American journalism community. I was reared in Haiti under Papa Doc, a brutal dictatorship where they basically killed journalists that didn't go along with the program. And I came here to the United States, thought I landed in paradise, went to the best school, you know, Columbia, came out and realized, oh my God, it's all, you know, it's not true. It's completely corrupt. And so I had my paradigm shifting moment, but which I won't go into right now because this is about you. I want to know what your paradigm shifting moment was. What moment was it when you went, oh my God, this is terrible. This is worse than I ever thought.
It was when I confronted the FDA and the CDC and I tried to talk to them about, hey, we discovered like safety signals that are off the charts in the VAERS system. Can we meet with you to talk about it? And so we can show you our data. And this is not me talking. This is Jessica Rose, who's one of the world experts on the VAERS system. She's a scientist. She's published articles in peer-reviewed journals. She's an expert in this stuff. And she even had a YouTube video where she challenged anyone, hey, if I got it wrong, you know, let me know. And never got any challenges. So, you know, we thought we were going in with, hey, you know, we found a, you know, huge safety signal that you guys should be aware of, and we should alert everybody that these vaccines are not as safe as we thought. You know, clearly there was a mistake was made, and nobody answered. Nobody home. You know, and wow. And I had watched this video with this guy, Stephen A. Anderson, and he said, hi, my name is Stephen A. Anderson from the FDA, and I'm the top watchdog for safety at the FDA, and nothing gets by me, and I spend all day every day on safety for this vaccine. And so I'm like calling this guy and I'm emailing him saying, hey, we got to talk to you, we found like this huge safety signal, not sure why you guys didn't see it, but you should, you know, we should have a meeting. And nothing, zero. And I'm in touch with Janet Woodcock at the time.
Wow.
And Janet's returning all my emails and I'm saying, hey, really like to meet with your team about these safety signals. And she's saying, oh, no, you got it wrong because you just don't understand how to, you know, so she's like gaslighting me. You don't understand how to analyze this. And, you know, there's correlation doesn't mean causation. You know, she's giving me all this bullshit stuff. And I'm not buying any of it. And I'm saying, hey, you know, maybe we should just meet with your folks for, you know, 5 minutes or so, and they can just set us straight, because it's not just me. And she said, no, they don't want to meet with you. Yeah. So, you know, you can't be portraying yourself as, yeah, we're really looking for safety signals, because they're like the Maytag repairman, you know, because they haven't found a safety signal at all in any of this stuff. And so if somebody comes to them and says, hey, we found a safety signal, they should be like all over us. They should be like, hey, thank God, you know, we couldn't find anything ourselves, and you found gold somewhere. I mean, let's hear it. And I thought it'd be welcomed with open arms, but I was like persona non grata. And it's not just me, of course.
Yeah, but there must have been one moment, like, because you were trying to reach them and they weren't getting back to you. Okay, you know, they're bureaucrats, whatever. So you keep trying, nothing. And then something, though, must have turned the worm for you. Some moment where you went, oh, my God.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty, Maddie DeGary. So Maddie is one of the vaccine injured, and she's been terribly injured by these vaccines. She was a healthy 12-year-old at the time she got he got her shots, and she participated in the 12 to 15 Pfizer trial, and she got paralyzed less than 24 hours after she got her second shot, and she couldn't walk off the bus without assistance, and then it progressively went downhill, and now she's in a wheelchair, and it's very tragic, you know, in terms of her condition. And so I sent a message to Janet Woodcock, and I said, hey, Manny DeGary, how come you guys haven't investigated that? And she says, we promise we'll investigate. And a month later, nobody had called her. It's pretty, well, you know, there's no excuse for that one. There's no excuse on that one.
Manny DeGary, her story, there's, and I urge, you know, all our listeners to go to this website so that you can understand what it is we're talking about here. There's a website called realnotrare.com where vaccine injured people go and speak about their firsthand experiences. Maddie is there. Her mother speaks for her. These are videotaped. And I'll tell you, I've gone and I've looked at these things, and it makes me sick to my stomach. And I am on their listserv every day, sometimes 2-3 times a day, they list a new person. And it's just, I can't even explain. It's just nauseating. You know, and people like you, what's interesting to me, I guess, because I'm an investigative reporter, and it's been years now since I've experienced the high level corruption, which was unimaginable to me before I first experienced it back in the 90s. But now I see it quite clearly. And you, of course, you have a wildly successful life. The system has worked really well for you, and you have a good heart, and you're trying to do something here. And all these people, I noticed that a lot of these people who were part of your team, like, you know, Bulware, all these people are people who, you know, your nonprofit status was given to you by the Rockefeller philanthropy advisors, right? You know.
Oh yeah, they dropped us like a rock after I came out against the vaccine, and they said, "Hey, I see you came out about against the vaccine. Can you send us more info on that?" So I sent them that, and I said, "Hey, do you want to discuss any of it?" And they said, "No, we're going to drop you."
Yeah. Did you ever ask yourself why?
Oh, I knew why. I wasn't at that time. I wasn't that naive.
why do you, what do you know about the Rockefeller Foundation?
Well, it's counter narrative. I mean, they've been supporters of vaccines for decades. So
yeah, and anybody Peter Meinke, who's anti-vaccine. Yeah. And Peter Meinke, ironically, he was on your board, correct? Peter Meinke?
Correct.
He spent 30 years at Merck, the maker of ivermectin. And you know, Merck has been trying to, has always backed off from ivermectin for use as an early treatment protocol, basically because there's no money in it, you know?
Yep.
So a lot of the people around you, I mean, you didn't know, right? You were just surrounded by these people who were really on the other side.
Yeah, well, I don't think that Peter per se was on the other side, because when most of the people on the advisory board weren't talking to me, Peter was one of the few people that was still a bridge to those folks. So I don't have anything bad to say about Peter. I enjoyed my interactions with Peter, and I just think that these people are very unwilling to question authority and to acknowledge that they might have made a horrible mistake. See, nobody wants to look at the evidence. Nobody wants to answer any questions.
But that doesn't make any sense to me. That doesn't make any sense to me. Well, hold up now, because, you know, if you are a highly educated researcher, for God's sake, you're a researcher. I mean, you're supposed to be trained to think critically. You're supposed to come in with no bias. You're supposed to look, you pull that ball of string. You see where that research takes you, and wherever it takes you, whether you like it or not, that's where it is. And that's why I feel that you got into the situation that you're in, you know, because you do have a logical mind, and you do. You know, your logical mind said, oh, yeah, okay, this is a good idea. And then you had the research was done. The research made sense, you know, and that's what happened to you. And then you fell into this vat of corruption. And I don't know, these people, I don't understand how all of a sudden on this issue, their critical faculties have abandoned them.
Well, the problem is they're in it too deep. It's kind of like someone who's inside of a Ponzi scheme. There's no way out for them, right? And the medical community won't allow people to speak out, because a doctor who speaks out, like Meryl Nass, for example, will have her license pulled. And I know a physician in Canada who's in the process of having his license revoked, and he basically can't prescribe ivermectin anymore because he's being investigated by the boards, they call it the college.
Yes.
Yeah. So he had to sign this agreement saying that he will not prescribe ivermectin until the investigation is over. And they also want him to turn in the names of anyone who participated in any of this early treatment stuff or anything that has to do with the vaccine research. So they wanted names of other physicians so they can sanction them and take away their license. So there's this movement to silence any doctor who wants to speak out and speak the truth. And so people are reluctant to do that. Yeah.
I know Meryl. Meryl's a friend of mine. And Meryl has had, and this is what's hard for me, because, you know, I gave up a network career to blow the whistle. And it's not because I wanted to. I loved what I was doing, you know. But at some point, you either blow the whistle or you are no longer what you are supposed to be doing, okay? I could not call myself a journalist and just keep my mouth shut about being, you know, about having information suppressed about this investigation I was doing, okay? And I think, and Meryl has had the cojones to stand, she's standing up to it. She's fighting it. She understands that this is the only way you're going to address the system. And so I have a lot of sympathy and empathy for these people in that terrible situation. But when the boat of destiny floats by and says to you, you know, either stand up for what you are you know, and for the integrity of science and so on and so forth, or, you know, just keep your mouth shut. I don't think you should keep your mouth shut. You're in a privileged position. I'll be back. I'll get off my soapbox now.